Greetings, everyone. Happy Sabbath. Nice to see all of the faces here. We are a little thin. I know we've lost some to traveling in other areas, but still very wonderful to see all of you here and to share the Sabbath with you here. Last week, we went with some friends to the coast and enjoyed some of the Oregon, some of that wet beach weather that typically, you know, assaults our coasts here on the west. One of the things that was kind of fun about this trip, we did it with brethren, and we all agreed to an assignment before we got there, a personal Bible study assignment, of course, which some of us did to varying degrees of effectiveness. It's the nature of an assignment like this, going away for a vacation retreat for the weekend. But the assignment was to pick a character in the Bible that represents a good example of faith to you. And then describe why, give examples from their life or whatever, and then maybe tie that into yourself personally. I thought that was a great opportunity to explore a subject that I feel like I've been wanting to talk about this for a while, the subject of living faith. What is living faith? I picked a character that I'm not going to tell you about right now. I'll tell you about him later. Who we picked. Actually, it was supposed to be you pick him together, right? And so you would like to think Becca and I sat down and really meditated on all the characters. No, I just said, Beck, we're going to do this character. And she was like, okay, that's fine. So that's really the way it works sometimes. Anyway, I won't tell you who it is now that we picked. I'll tell you later. For now, I want to begin with this. When we talk about faith, living faith, you know, the Bible gives us lots of descriptions of faith. And so I think about that. I think, well, how deep, how far down does this rabbit hole go if we start to go down studying the subject of faith? I wonder, well, what's the first sort of imagery that comes to our mind when we think about faith? And I think about this scripture, Luke 17:5. I'm going to start here today. Luke chapter 17 and verse 5. Luke 17:5, and it says, "And the apostle said to the Lord, increase our faith. So the Lord said, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you can say to this mulberry tree, be pulled up by the roots and be planted in the sea, and it would obey you." And I think, wow, is that faith? If I could do that, would that mean that I'm a faithful person, that I have deep faith? Is that what Christ is saying? And is that what faith means then? If I don't have that level of faith, does that mean that I lack faith? What is Christ actually saying there? I mean, just as a preliminary review, what is he actually saying there? He's looking at a tree that grows where? On land. It flourishes on land. And he's saying, if you could command this tree, he's not saying a simple thing like go float in the river. He's saying, be planted. Change its very nature so that this plant, this tree that grows and flourishes on land will now grow and flourish in the sea. That ratchets that idea up to a new level, a very high level in my mind. The level of impossibility. Can you imagine a world where if that's what we could do, and everyone had that ability of pure righteous faith so that every one of us could command a tree to pluck itself up completely and utterly by the roots and plant itself someplace else, whether that's on land or in the sea, what kind of world would that be? I picture kind of a dangerous environment there. Trees flying around, mountains moving themselves arbitrarily. If you've got a cabin on a mountain and somebody decides that mountain needs to move, I don't think you'd be happy about that. What happens to your cabin? Maybe they don't think so thoroughly about what happens to your cabin while they're moving the mountain. I just don't think that this is sort of the picture of faith that we are supposed to be getting from this example, because we're human beings. I want to talk about living faith today. Practical faith. Everyday faith. I want to walk through, for me, for this presentation on faith, I'm going to walk through three elements that I want to present about faith today that's a part of what I'm describing for you as living faith, everyday faith, practical faith. Three key elements of faith that are necessary to having living faith. And I'm going to describe as we go through this what living faith is then. What is living faith? And I want to begin with asking the question, what is belief? What does it mean to believe? What does belief mean? If you look to the dictionary definition, Merriam-Webster online dictionary says this: one, it's a state or habit of mind in which trust or confidence is placed in some person or thing. Two, something that is accepted, considered to be true, or held as an opinion. Or three, conviction of the truth of some statement or the reality of some being or phenomenon, especially when based on examination of evidence. Interesting when you think about the variety of definitions within that. They all do have a common theme, though. Beliefs, however, are not static, meaning you don't inherit a belief. So it's not like this. So if you imagine that you would learn something, and that forever, from that point forward, that thing that you learned, that you would believe in that, and that it would never, ever change. That's not really even possible. God didn't make our brains that way. You'll understand a little bit more as we move through this. Let me read to you from an article I found in Indian Journal of Science, an article titled, "The Biochemistry of Belief." The Biochemistry of Belief. Here's what it says. Beliefs originate from what we hear and keep on hearing from others ever since we were children, and even before that. So we do develop beliefs as children from what we see, observe, hear, and are taught by our parents. We form beliefs from that. The sources of beliefs include environment, events, knowledge, past experiences, visualization, and so forth. One of the biggest misconceptions people often harbor is that belief is a static intellectual concept. Nothing can be farther from the truth. Beliefs are a choice. We have the power to choose our beliefs. Our beliefs become our reality. In fact, according to the article, our brains are wired to create and modify beliefs. In other words, we're made this way. Here's what it says. The sensory inputs, believe me, this is a long article. I'm pulling out just the relevant pieces for you. If you want to go find the article and read it, it's an interesting read, but it gets a bit heady. This is the relevant piece with regard to the fact that our brains are wired this way. It says, the sensory inputs we receive from the environment undergo a filtering process as they travel across one or more synapses in our brains, ultimately reaching the area of higher processing like the frontal lobes. There, the sensory information enters our conscious awareness. What portion of this sensory information enters is determined by our beliefs. Fortunately for us, receptors on the cell membranes are flexible, which can alter in sensitivity and conformation. In other words, even when we feel stuck, quote, emotionally, there is always a biochemical potential for change and possible growth. When we choose to change our thoughts, we become open and receptive to other pieces of sensory information hitherto blocked by our beliefs. When we change our thinking, we change our beliefs. When we change our beliefs, we change our behavior. Now, I want you to package that up and keep that as an understanding. That's what beliefs are. They're a choice that each and every one of us can make. We can change our beliefs based on new information. That becomes a choice that we make. And in choosing, we also then affect our behavior ultimately. One of the fun things that happens to us in life, and I'm very convinced God deliberately did this. There's a concept, and I'm going to try to keep it as simple as I can. The concept is called a cognitive dissonance. Dissonance. D-I-S-S-O-N-A-N-C-E. Dissonance. A dissonance is a disharmony. Cognitive dissonance means mental or disharmony in your thoughts or beliefs. So a cognitive dissonance is something that happens to us when two tightly held or firmly held beliefs come directly into conflict with each other. Now, the fun thing about cognitive dissonance is our brains hate it. We can't really dwell in this area where we have beliefs that conflict with one another. We need harmony in our beliefs to feel like we are at peace. Our minds can't handle it. Think of it this way. When you're hungry, you desire food. You need food that does what? It resolves hunger. And in the same way, when you have a cognitive dissonance, your brain craves resolution to that. There has to be a resolution. Now, we either resolve cognitive dissonances rationally or we resolve them irrationally. But they are always resolved. Now, one final point on rationality. There is two perspectives on what rational and irrational mean. Because when it comes to beliefs, we can view things the way God does, or we can view things the way man does. And there you're going to see as we move through this that rational from God's perspective is irrational from man's. And rational from man's perspective is irrational to God. So understand as we go through this, it's a very clear thing to say and to understand, but sometimes when I'm speaking, it's highly probable that I'll say it one way and I'll mean it the other. So bear with me as we go through this together. I want to walk through an example here of a cognitive dissonance, I guess, for lack of a better way to say it. But it's an example here of belief. And as we walk through this example of what is living faith, this is going to help us understand it a little bit better as we move down this road, and we're beginning here with belief. So let's turn over to Matthew chapter 14. Matthew chapter 14, and I'm going to begin in verse 22. So Matthew chapter 14 and verse 22. Hang on a second, I'm dry in the mouth here. Okay. Biblical example of cognitive dissonance in my mind. Immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he sent the multitudes away. And when he had sent the multitudes away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. Now when evening came, he was alone there. But the boat was now in the middle of the sea, tossed by the waves, for the wind was contrary. Now in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus went to them walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "Is it a ghost?" Or, "It is a ghost." And they cried out for fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid." And Peter answered him and said, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." So he said, "Come." And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid and beginning to sink. He cried out, saying, "Lord, save me." And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, "O you of little faith, why did you doubt?" Well, what's the dissonance here? So on the one hand, does Peter have any doubt at all that Jesus Christ is the Son of God? Well, he seems to have expressed all along that he believes that. So he knows and he believes in Christ. However, keeping this in mind, he was raised a fisherman. How many of us here know that if I jump up in the air right now, that I'm going to land right back down on the ground? With what level of confidence do you believe that? Is it 100%? How many of you think if I jump up in the air that I'm not going to land on the ground? Go ahead, raise your hand. I don't have that ability. So with 100%, I'm sure that if I jump, I'm going to land on the ground. With 100% sureness, Peter knows that he can't walk on water. He's been around fishing his whole life. He knows that people sink in water. Throw a rock in the water, what's going to happen to it? Pretty well aware of what we would call the laws of gravity. So there's no doubt in his mind about gravity. Gravity works. So he's asking for something outside of that. And what was he asking for? Command that I walk to you, and if you command it, then I'll be able to do it. Okay, now we have a dissonance here that's about to happen, because We're going to bring two beliefs in conflict with one another. One belief is, he is the Son of God and can make me walk on water. The other belief is, you can't walk on water. You'll sink. So how do we resolve the dissonance? Well, that's the question. How did Peter resolve the dissonance? Peter ended up resolving the dissonance by an irrational godly choice, a rational human choice. Fear took over. What happened to him? He sank. Christ had to bail him out of the water. He resolved the dissonance between these two things by saying, well, then it's impossible for me to walk on water. And what happened? He stopped walking on water. Interesting to note that we choose our beliefs. He could have walked all the way over and stood next to Christ on the water if he had chosen to believe Christ. Now, it's important for us to understand that belief is not enough. James uses an extreme example to illustrate this point to us. Now, I'm talking about belief in God when we talk about the beginning of faith. Belief in God. James tells us something interesting, right? James chapter 2. An oft misunderstood or misused passage by some. James chapter 2, 19 says, you believe there is one God, you do well. Even the demons believe and tremble. If we're talking about living faith and we begin with belief and we believe in God, is that enough? Does that mean we have faith? The demons believe in God. Who here would describe them as being faithful? Is that a term that we would associate with that group of individuals? Faithfulness? Would you say they have faith? They believe in God. You know, we as people, many people claim to believe in God. I went on to Barna. So Barna Group, if you're not familiar with them, the Barna Group puts out a lot of religious surveys and studies and things like that. They do a lot of research for institutions mostly. And so they put out a study here back in, or a report back in 2016 called State of the Church. And in this report they state this, 73% of Americans say they are Christians. And a similar percentage say that faith is very important in their life. So 73%, nearly 75%, nearly three quarters of Americans say they are Christians and that faith is very important in their life. But how is this reflected in their life? You say you believe in God. 35% attend a church service. Only 35% of those who profess to believe in God attend a church service. 34% read the Bible. 19% volunteer at a nonprofit. 18% volunteer at church. 17% attend adult educational programs. And 16% attend small groups. The point is, while we claim to believe in God, what is the behavior associated with that belief? If only 34% attend a church where God is supposed to be represented, look, the fact is, our belief in God cannot be perfect. We know that because we're human. And we are given the five senses by which to process our beliefs. If we can't taste it, see it, hear it, touch it, feel it, right? Whatever those senses are, if our experience doesn't, if it doesn't happen within the realm of those senses, then it's hard for us to incorporate whatever that is as a part of our beliefs. That's why God gave us senses. They enable us to process our beliefs. A God that exists beyond the detection of our senses defies belief. And in fact, our belief in God creates a dissonance that we have to resolve in our brains, either rationally or irrationally. Luke chapter 9, I'm going to go back here to Luke. Luke chapter 9. I'm I'm going to try to get through this carefully here. This is a very meaningful section of Scripture for me, so bear with me. Luke chapter 9, because we're talking about belief and the fact that we can choose what our beliefs are. How does this affect our faith? Luke chapter 9, beginning in verse 37, that's verse 37, it says, "Now it happened on the next day when they had come down from the mountain that a great multitude met him. Suddenly a man from the multitude cried out, saying, 'Teacher, I implore you, look on my son, for he is my only child.' And behold, a spirit seizes him, and he suddenly cries out. It convulses him so that he foams at the mouth, and it departs from him with great difficulty, bruising him," or wounding him, hurting him. "So I implored your disciples to cast it out, but they could not." And then Jesus answered and said, "O faithless and perverse generation, faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you and bear with you? Bring your son here." Now, what if you were that father? Or what if you were a mother in that particular case, crying out on behalf of your son afflicted with a demon in this way? Your only child. Think about that for a minute. And that a demon seizes your child. It convulses him violently. It hurts him. And it hurts him repeatedly. And it does this to your child repeatedly. And all you can do is watch. Can you imagine that circumstance? Let's read here over in Mark the same story, but I'm going to finish it here in Mark because Luke is a doctor and he writes somewhat clinically sometimes. And Mark here pulls out a little bit more, a little bit more meaning in this as we understand the subject of belief. Mark chapter 9 in verse 21. This is where the story picks up. Mark 9:21, it said, "So he," that's Christ, "asked the Father, 'How long has this been happening to him?' And the father said, 'From childhood. And often he has thrown him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. And if you can do anything, have compassion on us and help him.'" I try to put myself in that situation to imagine. We're talking about belief in God. And I have a child who has been afflicted by a demon who's gone through this since he was a child. That this has been happening to him, and I can do nothing about that. I am helpless. Have you ever felt helpless like that? Is belief a choice? Jesus said to him, "If you can believe, all things are possible to him who believes." And immediately the father of the child cried out and said with tears, "Lord, I believe. Help my unbelief." What's the dissonance here? What's the conflicting beliefs here that have to be resolved for him? He believes in God. He wants to believe that Christ is who he says he is, the Son of God. And if so, that he could heal his son. But what if Christ is just a teacher? He is, after all, a man. And that's the dissonance. He wants to believe, but it's awful hard to believe when your senses are telling you that this is not God. This is a man. Belief is a choice. This is why he said, "Help my unbelief." Faith requires belief in God. However, just believing in God, that there is a God, it's not enough. To our belief in God, we must add action. We're building here the case for living faith. And if we believe in God, that's not enough. The demons believe in God. We would not describe them as having faith. And so to faith, we must add action. James says it this way. If we go back over to James chapter 2. James chapter 2 and verse 14. "What does it profit, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but does not have works? Can faith save him?" If a brother or sister is naked and destitute of daily food, and one of you says to them, depart in peace, be warm and filled, but you do not give them the things which are needed for the body, what does it profit? Thus also faith by itself, if it does not have works. Now this word faith he's using, it's the same word that you'll see commonly used throughout the Bible. In this case, he's talking about belief. You say you believe in God. Prove it. How do you prove you believe in God? Thus also your belief by itself, if it does not have works, action, it's dead. But some will say, you have faith and I have works. Show me your faith without your works, and I will show you my faith by my works. Many want to try to use this today in modern Christianity as a criticism against the idea that works have anything at all to do with our life. They'll treat this as a legalistic perspective. Like you've heard the term legalism in church speak before, and it refers to somebody who thinks that they can earn salvation by their works. And that many would look to this and say, well, see, that's a justification of that. And we're saying, what James is actually saying is no. If you have faith, you'll have works that show us that you have faith. Because faith without works is dead. Belief, your belief in God, it's dead without works. It means nothing. Remember, the demons believe in God. How do we know for certain that this is the connection he's making? Well, let's drop down to verse 19 of the same chapter. Chapter 2 and verse 19. It says, you believe that there is one God, you do well. Even the demons believe and tremble. We read that, but keep going. But do you want to know, O foolish man, that faith without works is dead? Was not Abraham our father justified by works when he offered Isaac, his son, on the altar? Do you see that faith was working together with his works, and by works faith was made perfect? And the scripture was fulfilled, which says, Abraham believed God, and it was accounted to him for righteousness, and he was called the friend of God. You see then that a man is justified by works and not by faith alone, not only by his belief, but also by his works. Likewise, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out the other way? For as the body without spirit is dead, the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without works is dead also. Belief in God without works is dead also. What's interesting is that the book of James is written very near the same time as the book of Hebrews. And if you go over to Hebrews chapter 11, you'll recognize this chapter as being referred to as the Hall of Faith or the Heroes of Faith chapter. Because you have listed within this chapter a number of individuals, and the clear topic here is faith. And we begin with Hebrews 11 and verse 1, where it states emphatically, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Substance and evidence, those are tangible, aren't they? What is substance? Substance is defined as real physical matter of which a person or thing consists and which has a tangible, solid presence. Evidence is defined as the available body of facts or information indicating whether a belief or proposition is true or valid. And it says again, now faith is the substance of things hoped for. It's the evidence of things not seen. We believe in God. God is the unseen, is he not? We have hope in the resurrection unto eternal life. Have we experienced that? That's a promise, but we've only know that that's fulfilled by Jesus Christ. And we only know truly that it was fulfilled by Christ because it's been witnessed to. And from there, we build faith. We accept that he died for us and that the evidence is clear and proves that. But I wasn't there. I didn't see it myself. I wasn't alive then. Neither were any of us. What is the substance and evidence of our beliefs? In this case, our belief in God. What is the substance of that? What is the evidence of that? Verse 6 says this, right? That this kind of faith, without it, it's impossible to please God. What does verse 6 say? We drop down here in the same chapter of 11. But without faith, he's talking about substance and evidence, it is impossible to please him. For he that comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of them that diligently seek him. This kind of faith is evidence in belief. It is the substance of our hope. But what is it? Hebrews 11:4. By faith, Abel offered to God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained witness that he was righteous, God testifying of his gifts, and through it, he being dead, still speaks. Verse 7. By faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear, prepared an ark for the saving of his household, by which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. Verse 17, by faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. Notice that James and the author of Hebrews use the exact same example to illustrate living faith. He offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, in Isaac your seed shall be called. Concluding, Abraham concluded that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense. This really is a terrific example in my mind of living faith. It also helps us to understand how we can resolve dissonances in our brain. What do you think Abraham's dissonance was? Abraham concluded. Now, obviously, Abraham's dissonance was going to have to be this. I was given a promise by God. God will not break his promise. Isaac is the inheritor of that promise. If I kill Isaac, I kill the inheritor of that promise. My brain is going to glitch on this. He concluded with godly rationalism, irrational to man, rational to God, that God was able to raise him up if I strike him down, to follow God's command. So if I obey God, then God will have to resurrect him. It's as simple as that. To a man, that's irrational. But to God, that's the rational choice. And so he resolved the dissonance with godly, rational reasoning. As you walk through each of the heroes of faith, the common thread among them is action. You notice that we read, by faith, so-and-so did this and such. By faith, so-and-so did this or that. By faith, she did this or that. The action demonstrates the faith. This tells us that they're inextricably connected to each other. Belief in God with action. It's not, I believe in God and, hey, that makes me a faithful person. It's more than that. There's a third element of faith. But I want to walk through some examples to get us to this one. There's a third element of faith, because if I have really good belief in God, I'm stable in my belief in God, I don't have any doubt whatsoever, not a shred of doubt in my mind that there's a God in heaven and that God created me and I am a part of that creation, and I have absolute belief that God called me into his church. So my faith in God and my belief in God is perfect. And therefore, I have actions that reflect that. Okay? What might be missing? What can undermine that faith? Let's go back to our example of Peter, Matthew 14, 26. Matthew chapter 14, picking the story up here in verse 26. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It is a ghost." And they cried out for fear, but immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer, it is I, do not be afraid." And Peter answered him and said, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." So he said, "Come." And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus. Everything's working according to plan. We have perfect faith up to this point. Belief and action in harmony. But then something happened. Verse 30. But when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, "Lord, save me." So he courageously jumps out of the boat. All of his faith intact and whole, starts walking towards Christ. His faith is perfect at this point. Agreed? It has to be, because he's walking on water. Something he knows he cannot do. So there's a dissonance that wants to build in his brain, and he has a choice right now. I rationalize that with godly rationalization, or I use irrational manly thinking. Manly. And while he could have chosen to believe and to have faith that he could walk on water as Christ had commanded him to, instead he uses his senses of feeling the water, feeling the air, seeing the boisterous environment, knowing that he can't actually walk on water, and he chooses the irrational godly choice, the rational man's choice, to believe that gravity works on him like everything else. And he sinks. He sinks. And what led to that? It says he was afraid. Fear. You know, I'm going to give you some examples, but one of the most common elements you find biblically that undermines faith is fear. It is repeated throughout the scripture in examples. Fear is what undermines faith. Now, we saw earlier that both James and Paul referenced Abraham as a pillar of faith. But, you know, his faith wasn't perfect either. Let's go back to Genesis chapter 12. And we're going to see that there's a common element that's missing, and we are going to also learn that one of the main reasons why it's missing. Genesis chapter 12, we'll pick up the story in verse 10. Now there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to dwell there, for the famine was severe in the land. And it came to pass, when he was close to entering Egypt, that he said to Sarah, his wife, or Sarai at the time, Sarai, should have probably really researched how to say that correctly for you. Sorry about that. Let's go with Sarai. Anyway. I'm stuck. Now my mind is glitching on this. I'm sorry about that. And it came to pass when he was close to entering Egypt that he said to Sarai, his wife, "Indeed, I know that you are a woman of beautiful countenance." She's a stunner. "Therefore, it will happen when the Egyptians see you that they will say, 'This is his wife,' and they will kill me, but they will let you live. Please say you are my sister, that it may be well with me for your sake, and that I may live because of you." In this instance, what happened to Abraham's trust? Remember before this is the whole area where God is laying out the covenant with Abraham. And so, yes, he knows and believes in God. He's had a conversation with him. And yet, as he's sojourning, and he comes into Egypt, where's his trust now? Where's his faith in God? In whom does he place his trust here? It said very clearly whom he placed his trust, and it was not God. He put his trust in Sarai, his wife. His faith failed him. Because remember, it says that it may be well with me for your sake, and that I may live because of you. Talking to Sarai, his wife. Not that I will live because of God and the promise God made that he would make a mighty nation out of me and my descendants. Nope, it's going to be because you lie about being my wife, honey. That's what's going to save me. Now, we drop down to verse 17. We're going to see that God takes action and he restores Abraham's faith. Verse 17, same chapter, it says, "But the Lord plagued Pharaoh and his house with great plagues because of Sarai, Abram's wife. And Pharaoh called Abram and said, what is this you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she was your wife? Why did you say, she is my sister? I might have taken her as my wife. Now therefore, here is your wife. Take her and go away." So Pharaoh commanded his men concerning him, and they sent him away with his wife and all that he had. Now, you might think, okay, Abram learned his lesson. Learned his lesson, except for chapter 20. Let's go over to Genesis chapter 20. This is just to help us understand that faith is a thing that we grow through. We're not perfect. And Abram was not perfect either. In chapter 20, in verse 9, excuse me, chapter 20, let's begin here in verse 1. Sorry, note takers, I hate it when people do that. We're going to start in verse 1 here, read 1 and 2 first. Genesis 20 and verse 1, it says, "And Abram journeyed from there to the south and dwelt between Kadesh and Shur and stayed in Gerar. Now Abraham said to Sarah," now they're Abraham and Sarah, something dramatic had happened between these two events. So here we have Abraham and Sarah. "And Abraham said of Sarah his wife," or said to Sarah his wife, I'm sorry, excuse me, I got lost there for a moment, "she is my sister." And Abimelech, king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. Same event repeating itself here. Same event that's concluding itself, or repeating itself. Now let's drop down and notice that the reason that Abraham gave, once again, for hiding his wife's relationship from Abimelech. Here's the reason once again in verse 9. "And Abimelech called Abraham and said to him, what have you done to us?" Once again, here he's caught. Abraham's been caught having lied about Sarah, his wife. And Abimelech says, "What have you done to us? How have I offended you that you have brought on me and on my kingdom a great sin? You have done deeds to me that ought not to be done." Then Abimelech said to Abraham, "What did you have in view that you have done this thing?" Great question. Why did you lie about Sarah? And Abraham said in verse 11, "Because I thought, surely the fear of God is not in this place, and they will kill me on account of my wife." So, would you call that perfect faith? Where again was his trust? His trust again was in Sarah's lie. That would save him, but surely not God would save him. I would call that imperfect faith in somebody that is described as being a pillar of faith, biblically. An example of faith for us, repeatedly cited for our benefit. But yet we can understand that he was not a perfect man. He grew in faith. Remember that it's after all of this that Isaac's born, and that later God's test of Abraham's faith with the sacrifice of Isaac at Moriah. It was, in fact, that episode that confirmed for God Abraham's complete faith. His living faith was later confirmed through that episode. So even up until then, God wondered about Abraham's faith, his trust, his absolute trust in God. And it took that episode with Isaac to demonstrate it finally, once and for all. What is that episode? It's not Abraham saying, "No, I'll be faithful." It's Abraham proving through his actions that he would be faithful. He's not the only one of the examples we can look to. Elijah was a great man of faith, and he did fantastic and marvelous things. I won't read all of them to you for the sake of time. But let me just remind you of a few of the things that happened. If you want to read some of the fun stuff around Elijah, read 1 Kings chapter 17. Because we read here that Elijah caused the rain to stop for more than 3 years. He was fed by ravens, if you'll recall, during the famine down by the brook. Every morning and every evening, ravens brought him food. Now, that seems like kind of a miraculous thing, because I don't have ravens bringing food to our house. So we know that that was a thing, and God said this was what he was going to do. So we witnessed this thing, and certainly Elijah was a part of that. But remember, when the brook dried up, God sent him to the widow's house. Who? What was she doing at that time? Preparing the final meal for her and her son. The final meal. That's it. All we have left. So she was prepared to eat and die. And God sends a man there to eat with them. And that she's supposed to provide for. I mean, you got to think if you're her. Really? But obviously, the flour and oil lasted them throughout. All of them throughout. What an amazing thing he witnessed. And in 1 Kings 18, we read that as God instructed, Elijah caused fire to rain down on his water-soaked sacrifice. Remember that? You got 450 prophets of Baal, and you got trying to create a fire for their sacrifice out of nothing. Can't quite do it. Just can't really get there. And so what does Elijah say? Pour water in there. No, more water. No, even more water on there. That thing is so soaked. I mean, it might just be submerged. There's so much water there. And yet, he commands and God fulfills his word, and he casts fire down on that thing. And it not only consumes the fire that was, or consumes the sacrifice, but it licks up all of the water all around it. Completely. Evaporates it all. Elijah was right there. He was the one who actually fulfilled the command by saying the words God told him to. How hard is it to not imagine him as a faithful man? Right? He's got everything you need to be faithful, to believe utterly in anything. If God said, walk on water, that shouldn't be a problem at all from everything he witnessed. That should be no problem. And yet, 1 Kings chapter 19 and verse 1. We will turn here. 1 Kings chapter 19. Now you'll remember, after the sacrifice burnt up, Elijah commanded that all of those 450 prophets should be gathered up and taken out, killed by the sword, and that's exactly what happened. And then Ahab and Jezebel got word in chapter 19 and verse 1, and Ahab told Jezebel all that Elijah had done, also how he had executed all of the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, so let the gods do to me and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one, the life of one of them by tomorrow about this time. And when he saw that, he arose and ran for his life and went to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah. And he left his servant there. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree. And he prayed that he might die and said, it is enough. Now, Lord, take my life, for I am no better than my father's. Really? Everything that he'd been through, every single thing, the miracles he had been a part of and witnessed, he truly knew and believed in God. He's praying to God right here at the end. And he's asking for God to take his life. But where is his trust? That failed him when he ran because he was afraid. I can imagine that Jezebel's letter was tersely written. It was probably a scary deal. I mean, she was known to be a very violent woman. There's no question about that. And I'm sure that if God had allowed Elijah to fall into her hands, that it would have been a miserable, awful ending for him. The question is, who do you trust? If you rationalize the dissonance in your brain according to man's rationalizations, you flee. You run. If you use God's rationalization to resolve this dissonance, you don't flee. You don't run. You trust. You trust God. You believe God. So we see that living faith requires belief in God, action, and trust. All three are required. Each of us in this walk of life, we have a lot of opportunities to practice and to live living faith. I remember early in our marriage, keep in mind that Becca and I were baptized together on the same night in the same cow trough, I think, whatever that thing was that Mr. Hoyt had in his basement. But we were baptized together in 1987 before we got married. So our marriage has always been in the church. We've always been in the church. So not hard for you to imagine if I say, we believe in God. Have always believed in God. Since before we were married, we believe in God. And yet, early in our marriage, when money was really tight, we struggled with tithing. I mean, I like to think at the time that I was a smart guy. I look back now and I was an idiot. There's no question about it. But at the time, I thought I was a real smart guy. So I look at the numbers, and I'm looking at the numbers in the spreadsheet because I'm a spreadsheet guy. And so spreadsheets help you with the math, and I'm looking at the numbers in the spreadsheet, and the spreadsheet says, you don't have any money to tithe. And so tithing was a problem for me. Tithing was a problem in our marriage. You know, the funny thing is, it was a problem for our marriage. When you don't obey God, it falls out in many other ways too, by the way. And so we were struggling with this, and we struggled for quite a while with this idea that the numbers never justified tithing because we just didn't have enough money to tithe and pay the bills. But you go on long enough like that, and maybe all of a sudden one day you'll change your mind and start thinking, my way isn't working, so what other way is there? And I love this scripture in Malachi. We read this to each other and decided at that time that we were going to make a decision. Because belief is a decision you can choose to make. Malachi chapter 3. Probably you're familiar with this. Where God says, will a man rob God? Yet you have robbed me. But you say, in what way have we robbed you? His answer is very simple. In tithes and offerings. So this was us. And I'm staring at that. Will a man rob God in tithes and offerings? And I had to honestly say, yeah, we've been doing that. We were doing that. We were robbing God. I mean, that kind of humbles you when you start thinking about it in that way. We were robbing God. And he says, you are cursed with a curse, for you have robbed me. And I could look at our finances and say, I surely am cursed with a curse. There's no money here. No matter what I do, no matter how many hours I work extra, no matter how many contracts I land, there doesn't seem to be any more money. He says, you are cursed with a curse, for you have robbed me, even this whole nation. Bring all, this is the solution, he says, bring all the tithes into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house. And try me now in this, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such blessing that there will not be room enough to receive it. So we were staring at that scripture and that promise. We made a decision, a choice. I said, okay, the first thing that we're going to do is we're going to write that tithe check and we're going to put that second tithe away. That's the first thing we're going to do. Then we're going to see what we have left to pay the bills. You know, the funny thing is, immediately after we did that, immediately as soon as we cut that check, I don't even know if it was in the mail yet. It probably was in the mail. It was certainly in the mailbox. Beck got a new client. And that new client paid more than the total sum of all the tithes that we had just set aside. And from there, it just kept building. The more faithful we were, the more God kept rewarding us, blessing us for that faithfulness. We made a choice. We chose to trust God. He said that he would do this if we would do our part. So we did our part. And sure enough, he did what he said he would do. Trust. But we made a godly, rational decision, not a manly, rational decision. We added trust to our actions and our beliefs. What is living faith? It's the faith you live every day. If it became illegal to believe in God, to have that faith, Would there be enough evidence in your life to convict you? That's the question. Because that's the substance and the evidence that's required that demonstrates our faith, our belief in God. That there is substance in our life, that there is evidence in our life of that belief. That's what Paul is talking about in Hebrews when he says, the substance of our hope, the evidence of what we believe in, the unseen things we believe in God, our belief in God. That there should be substance and evidence in our lives that proves that. That's not the Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego faith, right? I mean, if you want to look at the extreme, we could look at them and say, well, that's perfect faith. When was the last time any of us were asked to bow down to a golden idol at the threat of being thrown into a fiery furnace? Most of us are not going to face that kind of threat in our life. So does that mean we don't get to have faith then? Because that's in the Bible. That's an extreme example of that's in the Bible. But you know where it's not listed? It's not listed in Hebrews. You're not going to walk through your life having to face a fiery furnace or a den of lions. Most of us don't have that threat. Most of us just have every day in front of us where we get up with an opportunity to live our faith, to make decisions today, to change beliefs that are wrong when I'm confronted with them. That's the hardest part, but that's faith. That's living faith. The examples we have in Hebrew are very simple for us, aren't they? Because they're normal things that happen in normal lives. Abel gave an excellent offering. Enoch pleased God. Sarah conceived and bore according to the promise. Abraham offered Isaac. Moses forsook Egypt to suffer the fate of his people. That's cited specifically. He made a choice. The walls of Jericho fell down because the people in faith marched around exactly as they were told to do. Rahab received and protected the spies of Israel. It was accounted to her as faith. These are simple things that any one of us could have done. That's why they're there, in my opinion. That's why he used them, because they're simple. They're tangible. We can relate to these things. They're everyday decisions. They're get up today and live your beliefs. You believe in God? So do the demons. What actions in your life prove you believe in God? Do you trust God? Let me end this message today with a quote from the character that we selected. The character we picked was Joshua. I like the story of Joshua a lot because I think in the church, if you go back far enough in the history of this church, you can relate a lot. We can relate and see parallels in Joshua inheriting the duties of taking Israel into the promised land. And I look at the man, and I look at his life, and I look at all of the things that he was confronted with and the challenges that he faced. One of them being that he was one of the spies who went in to spy out the promised land. And how many of those who went in came back and gave a bad report? That's another example of where you have two elements, but the third element is corrupted by fear. Because the 10 of the spies went in and said, yeah, it's a great land, except for the sons of Anak live there, and they're big folk. They look back at Israel, who's a tribe of what? Nomads at that point, fleeing. What was their big story of conquering anything? They ran from Egypt. They ran from the armies of Egypt. They ran. If you're one of the spies and you're looking at warrior peoples in the new land and you look back at your own people, they're not a warrior people. They're a bunch of nomads. We're going to get crushed. We're not going to take that land. Fear conquered them, undermined their trust in God. Happens a lot. Happened a lot for them. Joshua and Caleb stood up and said, let's go take it. Where was their trust? They believed God. It's not just about believing in God. They believed God. When he said, this is your land, I have given this to you. They're like, okay, let's go. That's living faith. That's why he's such a great example. But he's surrounded by what? Is he surrounded by living faith? In Israel? If you're not sure of the answer to that, go back and reread the first five books. And then all the first and second Kings and all the first and second Chronicles. And the prophets. And the writings. Because they were not surrounded by faithful people. And so in a sea of people that cannot be faithful to God, what does Joshua say at the end? The very end, his last words, Joshua 24:15. Joshua 24:15. This is his last statement, and it just really touches me. And if it seems evil unto you to serve the Lord, because it certainly did seem evil for them to serve the Lord, he says, choose you this day whom you will serve. Choose. Choice. We get to choose. Every single day we get to make a choice. Whether the gods which your father served on the other side of the flood. Who are you going to serve? The gods which your father served that were on the other side of the flood? What led to the flood? The gods they served were not the God in heaven. Or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you dwell. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. That was his decision. Because that's the life he led. Joshua is a great example of living faith.